It's very good to be here with you tonight. Big night. So much going on. Super Bowl parade this morning. Super Tuesday primary elections going on. Mardi Gras. I think I'm going to talk to you about any of those things tonight. I want to talk to you tonight about Kyudo Nakagawa Roshi, who was my first teacher. My first teacher in the flesh. I stumbled on Zen when I was 16 years old. I don't remember, to the bookstore, old bookstore in the town where I grew up, looking for a book on haiku, for some creative writing assignments in my junior year in high school. And I found this little haiku book, and next to it on the bookshelf was this little Zen Buddhism book. And I bought both of them, and I went home and I read them. I don't have the haiku book anymore. I still have the Zen book. I found it, holding it together with a rubber band. Now it's a tiny paperback falling apart. And I started rereading it a couple of weeks ago, trying to find out, see if I could find out again, what was it in that book that so caught my imagination? I've read the first chapter, but I have no idea yet what caught my imagination, because it seems kind of dry and dull all these years later. But I remember that I was really very taken with it. And I went off that summer to work at a Quaker work camp in rural North Carolina. Took my little Zen book with me and read it all summer, and I got the other 16 and 17 year olds to shave my head during the summer. I grew a little beard for the first time, and I got myself a big stick to walk around with. I felt like I looked like the monks in D.T. Suzuki's book. I tried meditating, and I wasn't very good at it, but I had this Quaker meeting every night, and I went to the Quaker meeting, and that was sort of like Zen, it seemed to me. It's the closest thing to meditation I had ever done. I did that. Over the next 30 years, I kept trying to sit. And I was usually better at sitting on vacation. And I'd get it going, and I kind of taught myself how to do it. Wasn't doing it right, but I was doing it. And I'd come home from vacation, and I'd keep it up for 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. And then I would get too busy or overwhelmed or whatever. Maybe during the year I'd buy another book about Zen, read something, and then I'd try sitting again. I'd keep it up for 3 days. Or I'd go on another vacation, and my life would calm down a little bit, and start sitting. I don't know if I ever really kept it up for a week even. But I kept trying. Sometimes it was a book. Sometimes it was a movie. Kurosawa made these wonderful movies in Japan about the samurai. And I see, they were very Zen movies. And I'd sort of catch, somehow, no matter how it was mixed up, I sort of could catch this Zen spirit. They made this, somewhere in there, must have been in the late late 60s, maybe early 70s, they made this TV series, miniseries, one of the first miniseries out of James Clavell's book, Shogun. I watched Shogun, got the book, read the book three or four times. There was a flavor in that. And I would try sitting. And I couldn't keep it up. About 30 years into this practice, if you want to call it that, going through what I guess was a midlife crisis, with the help of the sage of the I Ching, I managed to start sitting every day and kept it up for a couple of months, which was pretty amazing, and went looking for a group to sit with. In 1959, I couldn't find a group to sit with. I didn't know to look. I was 16 years old. Where was I going to go anyway? But 30 years later, I look in the yellow pages at that point, or maybe it was the white pages, the Manhattan phone book. It would start under Zen, and you could find probably half a dozen groups in Manhattan. There must have been more than that, but half a dozen where their names began with Zen. And I went and tried them all out. They were interesting. I mean, I didn't try them all out. There was one that wouldn't give you much information. It said, just ring the bell. somewhere in the East Village, in the days before the East Village came back, you know, sort of somewhere in Alphabet City, and it was not a great time for... I didn't know what was going on there, so I didn't try that one, but I tried four or five other groups in Manhattan. And I probably chose the Soho Zendo because they had sittings on an evening that fit my schedule. And I went there, I did their... They're very, very strict, Soho Zendo. None of the stuff that we let people get away with would they tolerate at all. So you go for this beginner, you have to go for this beginner's instruction, I think 4 weeks in a row. You got to go every Wednesday night, something like that. And then they say, you know, you got to be able to sit still for 30 minutes. And if you can't sit still for 30 minutes, just go home and practice on your own, and you can come back when you can sit still for 30 minutes. So I pushed, got myself up to 30 minutes, and went to try it and set three 30-minute periods in September with them, and sat every week, was sitting every week with them. And maybe somewhere toward the end of November or something like that, they tell me Kyudo Roshi is coming, who I've never heard of. And they convinced me to do the Sesshin, even though I've only been sitting for, you know, 6 months, or maybe less than 6 months if you count what I was doing on my own, and 2.5 months with them. But they said, you know, the first Sesshin is wonderful. It's grueling, but it's wonderful. You'll be glad you did it. You can do it. I signed up. Kyudo Roshi had founded the Soho Zendo. He lived there, lived in the Zendo, in a little room, which was also the interview room, I think. It's kind of a big room with the Zendo, and there's a little interview room, which is also the changing room. And I guess it was another room that was his bedroom. And a kitchen, and two bathrooms. And that was his place, and he was there. He established that Zendo, and he had established a group in London and a group in Israel. And he'd go out a couple of times a year to London, a couple of times to Israel. But mostly he was in Soho and felt that he had really settled down, that this was his life. He was a He was a successor of a really major Japanese teacher, Soyen Nakagawa. Same last name, but not related. Nakagawa is a fairly common Japanese name. And although he was older, in years he was younger than in terms of his Zen study time than one of his Dharma brothers. So when Soen died, Kyudo's older brother, older in the Dharma, became Soen's successor and the abbot of Ryutakuji. And Kyudo went on to do something else with his life, which was to bring the Dharma to the West, settle down. That his Dharma brother died rather suddenly and very young. So Kyudo, who had settled down in New York, gets called back to Japan to become the abbot of Ryutakuji, which is a major Rinzai temple. And at the point that I get to the Soho Zendo, he's already back. He's the abbot of Ryutakuji, and he's coming in once or twice a year to lead these week-long sessions. And I'm pretty new at this practice, but I'm going to do it. So I go to the Sesshin. Sesshin is a retreat. So I go in, and unlike, some Zen places in America, including, most of them in our lineage, the teacher tends to make a kind of grand entrance, more or less grand. Some less grand, but still grand. It's probably the Soto way. But when you arrive for the Sesshin at the Soho Zendo, he's already sitting. He's on his cushion, and he's sitting. He sits facing the room. We would sit facing the wall. So you walk in, but you see him sitting there, just by the door, sort of like where I'm sitting. And he was like right out of the book, from high school. He just sat so still. Not falling asleep. There was no kind of sign of falling asleep kind of thing. Just still. Completely alert. Totally still. And I thought right away, this guy has something that I would love to have in my life. I sat with him then, that Sesshin, and probably a total of five, maybe it was six sessions, five sessions, over a period of about 2.5 years. Some of you have already heard some of the memorable things that he said. He said very early on, maybe the first Taisho that I heard him give during that first session, and he said, you've all heard this. I've been here around. He said, in Japan, in the monasteries, for the first 7 years, the monks just count their breath. In those monasteries, they're sitting 3 hours a day on days when they're really not sitting much. That's just the baseline. We say, sit a half hour a day, They're sitting, their baseline is 3 hours a day. That's before breakfast and after dinner. They're working during the day, but they're getting in 3 hours of sitting a day. And for the first 7 years, they're just counting their breath, which is sort of the preliminary practice. Yeah, and you know, when I heard this, it's crazy. You know, I wanted this peace in my life. And I thought 3 to 6 months was a pretty reasonable time to give this. And he says 7 years. He said he had a lot to say. It's hard, sometimes hard to understand him. When he was in Japan, the Soho Zendo, I think it was on Thursday nights, would have a Dharma talk like this. But he was the only teacher there. He was really kind of the only everything. He really ran the whole show. That he was the cook, and he played all the instruments. I don't know if any of you remember Spike Jonze. It was on TV when I was in high school. And he had all these contraptions on. He's a drum. He had playing a couple of instruments with his feet and a couple of instruments with his mouth and three or four instruments with his hand, including a bass drum and stuff like that. And he was like a one-man band. And Kyoto Roshi was a one-man band, and he had all these different Japanese instruments. There were about five or six of them. And in our Soto tradition, we get five or six different people playing all these instruments, the little orchestra going for some of the liturgy. But he had all this stuff going himself. And he was the chief cook for the retreat. He would let some other people help with the food preparation, but he did all the cooking. He would serve tea at least a couple of afternoons toward the end of the session. He would whisk up this green tea in the zendo. And he would bring these little, it's very bitter, Japanese green tea. This has a different quality than the sort of the green tea in the tea bag thing, you know, because it's, you can kind of still taste it, you can still taste all the powder, kind of, yeah, you could, it's thicker than, right? And it's very bitter. So you know, these little candies that you take in your mouth before you drink the tea, and he would bring the candies. He would do the tea thing, he'd lead the chants, he'd do the interviews, he'd give the talks, he'd do the cooking, and he'd supervise the cleaning. He cleaned every day. There's always a work practice thing. Big wooden zendo, and he would have you have to sweep the floor, you have to get all the cushions piled out of the way, and you sweep and mop, and then you move the cushions over to the side that you've mopped. And it's basically, he's got this zendo is now divided into about four mop strokes. So you do this length thing. He's running in to correcting people who are sort of, mopping American style, you know, he's kind of freestyle mopping and stuff like that. He's got everything going. And he would complain about how, what slobs Americans were. Had some of this Japanese intensity around cleanliness. He had this pet peeve that the Americans, we were all Americans, we'd take turns getting, we'd sleep during this thing. Most of us would sleep in the zendo, we'd eat in the zendo. You had these two bathrooms, and people would, use these bathrooms, and sometimes during the break you could take a shower, but you go and you get washed and shaved and brush your teeth in the morning. And turns out, not only me, but it turns out most Americans, most members of the Soho Zendo, when they floss, now most people when they floss, these little spots get on the mirror. But most Americans, much to the aggravation of Kyoto Roshi, after they floss, don't clean the mirror. Uh, I complained to him about the pain in my knee. We, you know, we were sitting, I don't know, 7.5, 8 hours a day during the session. Your knee gets sore, and I'm complaining about my the pain in my knee, and he tells me this story. Some of you have heard this story. Part of the reason that he was sort of the junior person with his Dharma brother there was he started his in the monastery late. He didn't start in the monastery until after he graduated from college. But he was on the judo team or something like that in high school in judo, and he got kicked in the knee in high school, and it shattered his kneecap. He was 80 years old when he died in December. So, you know, it was 65 years ago. Knee surgery was not at all what it is today. So I just sort of left him with this knee, you know, sort of healed enough to walk, and he was fine and got through college and stuff like that. And then he enters the monastery, and they start sitting a minimum of 3 hours a day, and his knee hurts. Well, it's understandable, sitting in a full lotus with a shattered kneecap, and it hurt a lot. And he said, one day, after 11 years in the monastery, suddenly no pain. And I knew what he was telling me. He was telling me, you know, don't be discouraged. This is an encouraging story, you know. Your knee may hurt now, but you keep on practicing, and in about 11 years, it's probably going to stop hurting. And he taught me to sit. So for him, we talk about sitting still first. He didn't really focus on sitting still, because they wouldn't let you sit there until you could sit still. That was, you know, go home and learn to sit still. But he worked on posture. Now you count your breath, because you count your breath, so you have something to do, but he's not. You go in for your interview with him, and he just starts on your posture. I mean, you have a question, he'll do something with your question. Tell me his knee story, but what he's going to work on with me is my posture. So it took me about 2 years with him. I didn't see him all the time, but I was working with him for 2 years before he was satisfied enough with my posture to start talking about the breathing. You know, because, and there's a rationale behind that. You know, it's like you really can't breathe until you can sit straight. He had a wonderful teacher. But he was in Japan most of the time. And then when I'd been sitting there about 2.5 years, I guess, going on toward three, I think maybe toward three, a trip, you know, I don't know, there was some sort of crisis in Japan, and the trip to the United States was canceled. Were postponed. And then it was canceled, you know, I don't know, some number of months later it was canceled. I was feeling really frustrated. That it was looking like it was going to be a year from the time I had seen him till I would see him again. And I had this feeling, you know, I needed to be working with a teacher who I could see more often, and sort of, you know, serendipitously in my life, as these things happen, you know, when you need them, somebody appeared who said, you should go check out Bernie, sent me up to see Bernie Glassman. And for a variety of reasons, a bunch of things clicked for me with Bernie, and I stayed with Bernie and Jishu. You know, I would think from time to time that I should, you know, particularly during August when Kyoto usually came in, that I should go do another sesshin at the Soho Zendo with him and thank him for this teaching. But life was busy. And I didn't have that many weeks free, you know, so I wanted to, for years, I wanted to spend those weeks with Bernie and with Jishu, and then after Jishu died and Bernie was on the West Coast and I was doing the study with Bob, Roshi Kennedy, you know, it was if I could get a week for a sesshin, that I wanted to spend it with Kennedy, or I would spend a week visiting Bernie in California, or whatever thing was, and I didn't get back to Soho Zendo. So here's a digression. When I was about 29 years old, my father, who had had a couple of heart attacks, decided to leave my mother. He tells me this sitting in the grandstand at Shea Stadium during the baseball game, which was like a very shrewd maneuver on his part, because he knew I was going to start screaming at him there, what are you doing? You're ruining everybody's life. But, so, you know, he moves out. He moves into this sort of horrible furnished room. It was totally depressing, and I had a pretty hard time with it. After a couple of months living in this room, he moves in with this other woman in her apartment, which on one hand I thought was a big relief because I didn't have to worry about him living in this horrible room anymore. That was intellectually, you know. Otherwise I was not so comfortable with this new arrangement. You know, he always wanted me to come visit, and I did go over there to their apartment, that apartment, a couple of times. He would want me to stay for dinner. That I couldn't do. You know, it's like, I don't know whether I thought I owed it to my mother not to eat there or whatever the thing was, but I wouldn't eat. So his birthday, my father's birthday is December 8th, which is also Buddha's Enlightenment Day. And when he's, that first birthday that he's been out of the house, he wants me to come for dinner on his birthday. I really don't want to go. You know, I'm feeling, you know, I got this righteous position not to bless this relationship that he's in by not eating there. But I decide, I don't know why, I decide to go and have dinner there. It's December 8th that year, it's on a Friday night. And they go there for dinner. Sunday, he has another heart attack. Ends up in the hospital. He's in a coma. I go see him in the hospital. He looks completely gray. Overnight from Monday to Tuesday, he dies. I was, you know, it's interesting, but I was enormously relieved that I'd gone there for dinner. That it would have been like a huge burden to have him die. You know, with my having refused his last request or something like that, you know, and having sort of withheld that kind of thing from him. But I am left with this feeling that I did postpone year after year, 15, something like 15 years, maybe more, making the time to go see Kiyota Roshi, to thank him for his teaching. I knew this was not a sore point for him. I doubt that he had any recollection of me. You know, so many sesshins that he led, did he remember that I had been there for a few years, then wasn't there? I doubt it. But he was very important to me. And he gave me great gifts. And I postponed thanking him. Thank you, Kiyota Roshi. Thank you.